Accession number 22673, Reel 6.
Tom Wade, Reel 6.
You were constantly running to these little wooden contraptions over the side of the ship, and queuing again sometimes, in case they, out of fear of being caught somewhere else, going to the back of the queue and just waiting for a second visit. It was terribly crowded on that ship's deck because the Japanese cookhouse or galley to supply us with food was on that same deck with this. So a refrigerator, not a refrigerator, an ice box for holding meat, which we were supposed to get in our soups. We were only fed twice a day on board the ship, and that felt terrible. We weren't used to that at all, or anything like it. Once at 10 o'clock in the morning, once at 4 p.m. And all the food was a small amount of rice. I forget how much the measure was. Small, a little more than a rice bowl, a sort of teacupful of rice, and perhaps a little bit more than a teacupful, a mug full of rice, and spread over it a soup, a soupy stew made of flour, water, and peeled onions, and a few slivers of pork meat. Very small slivers indeed. Oh no, I remember another thing. They used 14-ounce cans of Irish stew captured in Singapore for 600 men's lunch and dinner and evening meal each day. 16 tins only. So that plus some extra flour and some real onions cut up was the basis of the food twice a day for 600 men in the two halves, forward and aft of the ship. And eventually they found that the pork was brilliant green, emerald green on the outside. It had all gone bad because the refrigerator icebox hadn't worked well enough. And they took that out and sliced off the worst green, leaving peeled stripes and areas of light green on it, and we ate that pork. So they threw us these odd dark green peelings of meat overboard, and even the seagulls wouldn't touch them. Not one seagull snipped up any of this meat that was thrown overboard. They could see that it was bad. But we had to just eat what was left just below the surface of this kind of rotten meat, and we ate all that pork from there on. And so every single man in the ship, 1,100 now, had diarrhea, and the dysentery also had been detected again, the doctor said. So there were 1,100 men with diarrhea on this small ship, and these six wooden stalls fore and aft to handle all their latrining, all their efforts. Anyway, finally, we dropped the generals at Takao Harbour. Takao was the Japanese name for Kaohsiung, a place in southern Taiwan or Formosa. And there the generals disappeared from our sight. And they went off to a camp in that island first, and then later some of them were moved to Manchuria. Our men worked in the dockyard area, loading and unloading ships for 2 weeks there, and then our journey continued. And we took about 5 weeks to go to Japan, not counting the 2 weeks working in Formosa, I think. And we went to, and when they said Japan, they meant Korea, because Korea they regarded as Japanese and as Japan at that time. It was a colony. But for certain purposes, like in conversation and maybe other administrative purposes, they would call it Japan. So we arrived at Busan, the port of southern Korea, and had a terrible time there because first thing we did was they searched all our bags again and took away every knife and razor blade and piece of glass and compass and knitting needle, almost anything they took from us there. And then we had to march through the town. And we thought, oh, God, we're going to have to carry our stuff. And I'd collected somehow quite a few things, bags or something by this time, and with boots and other clothes in, and a tin of food. And he said, no, you can leave it. You'll come back here. And, of course, you never believe that, because the army says that quite often, and it's not true, too. But when the Japanese said it, we certainly didn't believe it, but it happened to be true. So they marched us north, then west, then south, and we realized we'd just been taken in a big circle to show us off to the population of Pusan. And the whole of Pusan was out that day to see us. It was a busy little port, Pusan, the main port for South Korea, and it had a certain white Russian population, and we saw them among the crowds watching us, walking on the street. Also, they'd chosen to let us take to stage this march on a national holiday, so that everybody was out in their Sunday best to watch us. And it was quite staggering, actually, from my point of view. It was very staggering to see all these people in their best national costume, the Korean women all in their coloured top and different black or other colour skirt, all the men in their pure white clothing, which they use all the time. It originally started as mourning for the royal family, but the mourning went on so long that they never got out of it, and they stayed. It became the national everyday dress. So they wear this white clothing, not cotton exactly, but with a sort of slightly silky sheen to it. It's been treated in some way. I forget how they do it. And it's a very handsome national dress. And they keep it extraordinarily clean, considering they work in the fields dressed like that and in factories.
What was their demeanor toward you?
Oh, just interest, that's all, yes. Very little boasting or anything like that. Japanese would, prisoners, and laugh. Japanese children and some Japanese men would laugh and point towards us and say prisoner, say something about meaning prisoner, which I learned later. And little boys would hold up their hands like surrender, you know, and jeer at us in that way. But we paid no attention because we were much too busy just trying to keep alive and find something to eat and something to drink and so on and so on. So we paid no attention to them. Nobody else, the few foreigners who were all, I think, white Russians, paid any special unkind attitude towards us. So after marching through that, we went to the railway station, got in a train, and went up overnight to Seoul, the capital of Korea. Japanese called it Keijo at the time. It was just their name for it. Seoul is the name that counts. And there we marched to a warehouse and moved into that. It was a four-story warehouse, counting the ground floor, four-story warehouse with earth floor on the ground floor, so we didn't use that. And we were told, slightly fewer, were to go into this building, and this would be our camp. So we occupied first, second, third floors of the house, of the warehouse. It was like most warehouses. It had very small windows, only about 3 foot by 2.5 feet, something like that, and well spaced, very well spaced, so that there was not much light inside. And yet we lived inside those and read books day after day inside in that light for years after that. The floors were divided into four main halls or rooms, all with platforms on both sides of a walkway. The platforms about a foot and a half high, which were the living and sleeping space for the men on both sides and ourselves, and a walkway in the middle. And what you did in Japan and Korea was you took off your boots you'd been outside in and dropped them under the edge of this ledge and then climbed onto the ledge in stocking feet, and then you lived on there, and you ate your meals on there, and stayed the whole day on that ledge. There were separate small rooms for some majors and colonels, but that was where all of us lived, and all the soldiers lived in exactly the same way on these floors. They gave us three blankets at first, which which was September, and that was okay for a little while, but very soon we were asking them for more blankets, and by December they'd given us four blankets each, which helped, because and we made very narrow beds, sleeping areas for ourselves, no beds at all. We made a sleeping arrangement for yourself with your blankets. We made it very narrow and very much doubled, trebled blanket underneath us, and about three layers to go on top of you, four if you could manage it, usually three layers to go on top of you, and then your great coat, if you had one, or other coat on top of that to help keep you warm. It was very cold in winter, and we only got a stove, after much begging, we got stoves in each squad room in mid or late December, and they were taken away in March. So we had some heating from charcoal during the worst part of the winter in Korea. And it was very cold winters in Korea. Strong wind, very cold, temperatures going down a little below zero nearly every day, and this building not geared for warmth in any way, simply a warehouse for materials, for food and so on, in normal times. And we tried to make the best of that. We put on our shows again. We moved our books around a lot, trying to everybody have a chance to read all any of the good books that were there. And books were terribly important. And we had quite a lot in Korea, finally. Oh, yes. They approached the YMCA, the International YMCA, made efforts to provide prisoners of war in Japan with books and gardening and farming tools, because they thought that's what they would need, and they were dead right. This is exactly what we needed, and they supplied them. They brought books from all the high schools, and American and Canadian high schools, which have been in Korea and in Japan, particularly Korea, in this case, all Korea, I expect. And there were some quite good books amongst them. And I read Plato's Republic, which was one of the best books I've ever read in my whole life. Read that in prison camp. And read War and Peace and Pride and Prejudice and other things which are available from school libraries. And a mass of books, a whole mass of books. Unusual things too. My Country and My People by Lin Yutan. All sorts of books. But they were lifeblood to us. And poetry too. I read, for the first time, I read Wilfred Owen's wonderful poetry on the First World War there in prison camp. And it was the first books I bought when I got back to England after the war was a Wilfred Owen. A lot of good books. Some of the Russian authors too. Yes, a few of them in translation in English, you see. So books were very important to us, especially I think certain of us, not all of us, and they circulated regularly. Then otherwise, there was nothing special to do. We could play cards a little, but strangely, cards wasn't as widespread as I expected to see it. I thought there'd be a huge amount of card playing once people got into a situation like that, but only the keen bridge players and a few others who were going in for vante and things like that were the card players and poker. Not a great many. That slightly surprised me. The other silly thing that we did in prison camp was he had a vote early on arrival. How would you like the rice? Would you like it boiled? Or would you like it made into a soft mess? And by God, by 51 votes to 48 or something, the soft people won. They said it was always easy to digest, it was better for you, and it was better for you, especially for the sick and all that. And so for several months, we ate grey stirred, well stirred, mixed up rice pap. And it was dreadful, dreadful. And I thought, this is astonishing. Here are 25 or so elderly English officers telling us how to live on rice in Asia, where there are 1,000,000,000 people can tell you how to cook rice properly. But we didn't cook rice properly until we'd argued this again and again through till the following spring, sometime, or summer, when we finally got them to agree to boil rice for some of us, and let's, for the few who wanted it, to continue with this grey pap. Because rice, when it's stirred sufficiently and gets all soft and broken up, does turn into grey pap, not white at all. It's horrible looking. So they had that, and we turned eventually to boiled rice, which is edible and is the basis of all Chinese, Indian, Japanese, Thai, Vietnamese food. I think that irritated me more than any other little thing in Formosa, in Korea. God, that angered me. Having lived in China and been in Japan and all that, Malaya to be told how to eat rice and how to cook it by old majors who, most of them, been in Luggershall and Chatterick and Aldershot and so on and so on for more than half their lives. was beyond a joke. Right, so then we started work. They had to find work for us to do, and they did very quickly. First job was loading and unloading rice in rice bags. Rice is not kept in sacks in Japan or Korea. It is kept in sacks made of straw made from rice, the rice crop itself. So these straw bags, they leak a little, but that doesn't matter because they're fairly thick, the covering. And the tiny bit that leaks out simply doesn't matter. It's not it's negligible. So loading and unloading these rice straw bags full of rice or barley, occasionally might be wheat or other things, into trains and into trucks was what we did at these work jobs. And here the officers were very busy keeping the men under control and trying to get the jobs done properly, and also get the jobs done at least, so that we didn't get too much beating up, and always trying to soften blows and soften quarrels between groups of men or single men and the Japanese and Korean guards, because now there were more Korean guards around. The Koreans that we saw were not in the Japanese army, but were in a sort of militia. And some of them tried to outdo the Japanese. They thought it was their business to be more Japanese than the Japanese, to out-Herod, did not behave in a humane way at all towards us. But most of them were quite the opposite. Most of them simply did their jobs as well as they could, and at times would share a smile, or would even talk a little and say, one day career win, you know, something like that. One day career will do this. They were patriotic Koreans, and they wanted really the Japanese to go, because we all studied a little, at least not all, a few of us studied the history of Japan and Korea and wherever we could find any information on it. And we could see that the Japanese, having taken over Korea, made it into a colony, paid the Koreans from then onward at one level, and they themselves at a higher level, and given all the best jobs in Korea to Japanese, and then tried to settle Japanese farmers on the land in Korea, and all those farmers having given up the job and moved into the city and taken jobs at higher pay in the city, we saw that the Koreans had absolutely no love or understanding of the Japanese at all. Now, one officer did a foolish thing here. He began collecting clothes, an officer in my regiment, began collecting clothes to give to the Japanese, to the Koreans, and wrote a little note with a small bundle of small clothes, wretched little gift it must have been to, saying, war's going well, keep cheerful, Japan, Britain and America and Korea will one day, will soon triumph or something like that. Well, the Japanese Kempeitai, that's their military police, one of the fiercest and most efficient in the world, on a level with the Gestapo, really. They walked into the camp. They somehow got a hint there might be something going on. They walked into the work job at the warehouse this one day, searched around and found this bundle with this letter in it put there by this officer. Then it was the easiest thing in the world. Who was on duty that day? Two officers from this camp were working on this section. They came to us and arrested the two officers who'd been working on that section and one NCO who was in another camp. They'd moved a small number of our men to Incheon, which is the port for Seoul, and it was called, the Japanese called it, doesn't matter what they called it then, a slightly different name. And arrested them, took them off, questioned them for 2 weeks, and then brought them back. And one of them, they released. He hadn't done the dastardly deed. He was released on the promise not to tell a single word to anybody in his among us other prisoners of war on pain of death. And he said, "And we mean death." And he didn't say a single word to us of the situation. We only found out otherwise.
A single word about what?
About their imprisonment and questioning at Gestapo at Kempeitai headquarters. So, but the other officer, this single officer was sentenced to 3 years imprisonment and was sent off to a prison jail. Two NCOs from this other camp, or maybe it was three NCOs from this other camp, were also found lending money to the people who were supposed to be doing escaping. That was a slightly different story. Two men were supposed to escape, and so the people who had lent them money were arrested besides them, and they were given 1 year in jail or 2 years in jail. And I don't know exactly everything that happened to them because, of course, it wasn't my camp, and they were in jail when I left. But they survived, I think. But this officer, this poor young officer of ours named Piggott, Roger Piggott, second lieutenant, 20 years old only, went to Japanese prison camp, Japanese prison, civilian prison, I think, or maybe military. And after 3 years, he was sent back in 1945 September 1945, sent back to the headquarters where the rest of these loyals soldiers were in Seoul. And he was weak, and he had pleurisy, and he was weak and emaciated and deeply depressed. And he'd been one of the most lively and cheerful young officers. And he died 4 days after the end of the war in prison camp. But before, I never witnessed of course his return, but he went off to this prison. I saw him go, and I knew him very well. We'd been in the same company at the beginning in Singapore before I became intelligence officer. And anyway, that was the end for poor Roger Piggott. And we all thought he'd been bold but silly to be writing notes in his own handwriting and putting them in an obvious place, like under one layer of bags, above another layer of bags. I mean, there was nowhere else you could hide anything. There was nothing inside these warehouses except the stacks of bags. So what would you do if you were a Japanese sergeant going to search? Where did the prisoners go? They searched at 5 foot and 4 foot and 5 foot six only, and they found it there. God, it's so stupid. It's without thinking. People would be brave and bold young officers and soldiers dare to do things and then realize that they hadn't thought about it carefully enough and they'd been blatantly obvious and stupid. So they only went there. They only had to search a couple of places along the rows. They didn't bother to go to the bottom or high up. They just went along 4 foot to 6 foot, or 4 foot to 5 foot five, and they found it. So we shook our heads at that. Then we suddenly, and then by this time, George Baker and I had been really trying hard at our Japanese, because in this camp, we went out on jobs not every day as officers, only certain days, because there were enough officers to spread the work. So we had many days in camp, and we spent 3 and 4 hours a day learning Japanese in camp. And we'd ask for a book, a grammar, and they sold us a very silly, cheap grammar, which is like for travelers who want to try and learn Japanese. It was called Japanese in 80 Hours. Well, we said, we got more hours than that to spare. And so they found a better grammar, written by an Italian, a better grammar, a much better grammar than that. And that's what we used. And we made real progress. And we began to see the grammar and the reasoning and the writing. We began to learn the two other scripts in which Japanese is written. Besides using Chinese characters, which is the basis of all Japanese writing, Chinese characters, which they call kanji, there are two scripts. One, a very simplistic, squarish-looking one, straight lines, which they call kanji, which they call, the name escapes me in them. Another one, which they use for all foreign names in the Japanese newspapers and publications. So when you pick up a Japanese newspaper, there's Japanese language here in Chinese script, and then every now and then, rather simple-looking script, and it's spelling out Rondon, London, and Guadu Canal, and Hawaii, and so on. And you can read it quite easily. It only takes you to have to learn 26 or so sounds, or 30, to be able to read all the syllables that they use, because they don't use as many syllables as we do. For instance, they only have ka, ta, sa, ma, na, and wa only, and each of those has as the other vowel sound as well. So that's only 6 times 5, 5, 6, 30. That's all they have. 30 sounds and n. They sound n, as you know from the word yen yen and so on. The word at the end, n at the end of a word is okay. They can sound that, but no other word has a. Any other words have to end in a vowel sound. So we learnt Japanese, and we that way. This bar, we're making good progress, and we went out quite often with particular jobs where the language would help, or where we thought there was a guard who might talk a lot, and that we could learn more of the language from. And then we began learning Chinese characters, which is the basis of all the written Japanese. But of course, we had to learn them with the Japanese sound and Japanese word attached. So mountain, which I knew was shan in Chinese, becomes in Japan yama, their native word for mountain, and or sun, the Japanized Chinese sound, which they used in certain circumstances, is very useful in building up words. Instead, you can't build up words out of yama and so on, because they're too long, tsotsuke and so on. They're much too long, those words, to build up new words. So taking some new word, they simply use the Japanized Chinese sounds, and they put san, min, shi, hu, shu together, and it's quite easy to make up a new word. And that's how Japanese is written. The language could do with some simplification, especially having three scripts, but they haven't attempted it. They're very happy with it, and they like the fact that it is difficult for foreigners to learn. Not so difficult to learn to speak some good kitchen and business, ordinary day-to-day food ordering sort of Japanese, but to learn the intricacies and the polite talk scientific and diplomatic and so on language becomes much more difficult. And the Japanese actually say that they're very happy that their language is difficult for foreigners. So we'd made a lot of progress in that, and I was glad of that. But when I went to my other camp, I had to drop it, most of it. I couldn't really carry on. So I reached a certain level and had to stop. But Baker went on, and he became very good at Japanese. So then one day they said, we're going to send some of you to Japan, to Tokyo, where you'll do work nearer your peacetime work. And so that made me grimace because they knew I'd been a reporter in Shanghai, and they knew Jack McNaughton had been an actor and had broadcast once or twice on BBC. And they knew certain people were good musicians and so on. And that's what happened. One day we were called out and they were told that, Wado, they always call me Wado, ending the Wade in an O sound, because